doesn't that just mean that the car thief or whoever it is could just speed off from the cops and there's nothing you guys can do?
Welcome to my world, mate.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Amon, welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. So, Amon, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, my name's Amon. I'm a police officer. I've been a cop for over 7 years now. And, currently in Auckland. So
that's incredible. And my understanding is you were a banker and you changed to becoming a cop. Like, what happened there? That's a pretty big shift, man.
Yeah, it was a big shift at the time. But, I mean, I've always wanted to be a cop when I was younger. Like, even when I was a kid, I remember when I was a little kid playing with police helmets and toys and stuff in the front yard, chasing bad guys, trying to save people and be the hero, even when I was a little kid. So it was always like a dream in the back of my head and something that I'd always aspired to be but never really thought possible. And it wasn't until I actually got married that my wife encouraged me to actually apply after talking about our dreams and things to want to be in life. And she said, why don't you just do it? Why don't you give it a go? And so I did. But the thing was, I always knew being a cop, it was going to have to be a team effort, it's a big job and there's a lot of responsibility to it. So I wasn't going to go into it without, my partner being on board, but it was so cool to have that support right from the start. And after I tried out, I actually started passing all the exams and the physical side, which I was, I surprised myself with it, which was cool because it started turning into more of a reality the more and more I tried out, which was pretty cool.
That's incredible. So you're chilling in the bank doing your thing and you're just secretly hoping, there's going to be that moment where you dive over the teller, tackle the robber.
Yeah. It's funny.
But then you made your dream a reality.
Yeah, man. No, it's funny you say that, actually. I actually missed that moment the one time that it actually happened at the bank. There was this one moment where I actually went on my lunch break and I came back and it was like a crime scene had just occurred. But I think it was just this dude that was causing trouble inside the bank and being disorderly or whatever it was. But I came back from my lunch break and there was this guy being held down on the ground by three construction workers that ran in from next door and they were holding this guy down waiting for cops to show up. And then there was like this old lady crying in the corner and then my manager was like on the phone to the police. So it was like all on. I was like, what happened?
You're holding your sandwich like, yeah. No.
I was like, man, what happened? I totally missed it.
That's crazy. Did you go over and like sit on his feet so you could claim that you were part of the
criminal? I couldn't claim any credit for that one. But yeah, it was cool. Since then though, being a cop, I've had my fair share of good times and scraps and chases and all of that. But it's good.
I'm sure that's more than made up for that fateful sandwich that made you miss the
sure has.
Miss the hustle there.
Yeah,
so you changed from banking, you went in and you sat the tests, you passed, obviously.
Yeah.
And what was that like? Like graduating as a cop and then going out on your first.
Oh man. It was surreal, to be honest. I knew going into college, everyone around you is in the same boat as you are. So you're just studying and trying to get through the exams. And even as I graduate and, you go out and you leave police college, it still doesn't feel real. I think the moment that it actually felt like I felt like a real cop was when my friends or family first saw me in uniform on duty. I think it was their reaction when they saw me and they were like, oh, sheesh, this dude's like, he's a real cop now. Like,
yeah,
it's no longer just Eamon, you know, like, oh, it's Eamon the cop. Like, it was a big step back. And it was, I think a big thing for me as well was when I met Sybil's father, my wife's father, when he first saw me in uniform. It was a massive deal because he immediately, like, straightened his back in, like, in full respect mode and was like, whoa, this dude's for real. And it was at that moment, I was like, ooh, I've almost got, like, respect from this dude for the first time.
That's amazing. You're like, man, all it took was a police uniform.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. After all this time, should have done it ages ago.
Should have gone to the dress-up place. And, I know. No, it's not quite the same. Not quite the same, is it?
Exactly.
Man, so that sounds, like, pretty strange because one day you're just cruising around and, you know, being Eamon, and then the next day you graduate, you put on a police uniform and you are, like, take on all of that authority and responsibility and reputation that's gone for, you know, for years.
No, absolutely. It's another level when you think about it. When, you know, sometime you're just, one day you're a civilian and then the next day you realise you can take away someone's freedom just like that, you know. And it's just, it's another level of authority and power, and it's a privilege to take on that responsibility.
Yeah.
But it's good.
And how do different people, like, I mean, you mentioned all your classmates being in the same boat. Like, how do different people respond to that, like, massive shift?
Oh, there's so many different responses, to be honest. For me, it was an eye-opener, to say the least, just because of the sheer number of people that I deal with and the different types of people that I deal with. It was, I was pretty green coming into police, to be honest. I was super green and almost like too innocent to come into this job until going into my first domestic, you know, with he's beaten her up and there's blood all over the room and she's got bruises and cuts all over her or something like that. And I'm talking to her and she's, you know, wanting to, initially at the time, want to make a statement. So I'm making my first arrest on this guy. But for these, the way that they're talking about their relationship, it's normal. You know, this stuff happens every day. You know, he'd come home drunk. Sometimes she would instigate the violence just to get the beating over and done with because she knows it's going to happen. But this time it just went too far and the cops were called at this particular moment, you know. But even after dealing with a situation like that, moving through the court process, as a cop I'm thinking, sweet, yeah, we've got the victim statement, we've got the photos at the scene, like, yeah, it's a done deal. The court's going to, you know, deal with the whole thing. But people don't realise the victim is so essential throughout the whole court process. So if the victim turns hostile and doesn't want to proceed with anything and come to court later on, it creates a massive problem. And it's not really just about finding justice for the public interest. It's actually trying to, you know, figure out what's best for the victim as well. But if the victim is turned hostile because, you know, she still loves him, you know, that's the bottom line for her. She's stuck in this domestic violence circle. She'll always come back to, no, I still love him. I still want to, you know, I know he can change, all that kind of stuff, and try and basically refuse to proceed with the court process. That was a big shock to me when I first came in. And, you know, facing that and trying to figure out how to deal with that on a regular basis was a big challenge.
Yeah, that sounds very tricky, like having all of the, you know, the evidence and statements and thinking, yeah, this, you're going to go ahead and there's going to be justice served.
Mm.
But then if, like you say, the victim isn't keen to continue to press charges, there's nothing you guys can do by the sound of it.
Yeah, right? Well, it's still the police that are press charges, but the whole court process. Like, with the victims who don't want to come on board, The judge has to make the call, essentially, whether it's in the public interest to force the victim to come to court. And by that, I mean they would issue a warrant for the victim's arrest to come to court to give the evidence, because this is in the public interest. This guy's a menace to society. This happened to you, but we need to stop it from happening to other people. And so sometimes the victim would be summoned to court to give the evidence, and if they fail to appear, on rare occasions, the court may issue a warrant for the victim's arrest just to get that evidence in court to have the justice served, you know, which is something that really surprised me in the system as well. But that seldom happens, you know, because most of the time, if the judge gets the case and it's a he said, she said case, or there's no other witnesses involved, then it's like, well, if the victim doesn't want to be a part of this process, why are we even doing this in the first place, you know?
Yeah, and it seems like going out of your way to arrest a victim and make them come in and give a statement could also lead to them just being like, I'm not going
to. Because you have to consider, like, you're putting this victim through trauma over and over every time you bring this up.
Yeah.
They're going through this incident in their heads every time you talk about it. And so it's something you have to consider, is just re-traumatizing a victim whenever you do this.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a real eye-opener to, I guess it was a bit different than what you thought, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's very different to cops and robbers. You know, when you chase the bad guy, you drag him to the justice and you're like, cool, I've got him done, you know, job done.
Next one, next.
Exactly. Go catch the next bad guy.
Yeah. So what is it like? Do you rotate through different parts of the police force when you're starting off?
Yeah, so, I mean, on my first 2 years, we do our probationary period, if you will. Basically, you've essentially got 2 years to finish your permanent appointment or your workplace assessment. If you complete it within the 2 years or before then that's fine. But essentially, by completing the workplace assessment, you get promoted essentially from a probationary constable to a constable. So you got to get all your permanent appointments just to provide all this paperwork to say that you've attended all these jobs and that you understand everything and you know how to do your job, essentially. But in those 2 years, they move you around to different roles. So I first started coming out of college doing some road policing for a little bit, and only for like a couple of weeks, just to sign me off on getting, you know, the speed training and the laser gun on the road policing thing. And then it was straight into the front line for 6 months. And after 6 months, I went onto the booze bus section. We would drive around all of Auckland and set up checkpoints, and I'd be doing drink driving procedures on the checkpoints, you know?
Yeah.
And but I've moved around from there to comms. I've worked as a dispatcher for a year. That was probably one of the most stressful jobs I've ever had in my life, to be honest.
Why?
Well, because as a dispatcher, people don't realise every 111 call that comes in, it pops up on this dispatcher's screen. And I'd have four screens in front of me. And as a dispatcher, I'm responsible to read, understand, and dispatch that 111 call to a police car within a matter of seconds. And if it doesn't get dispatched in time, especially if it's a priority job, an alert would come up on the screen. A supervisor would come over to you and say, hey, what's going on? Why isn't this job being dealt with? Do you need help to get someone else to log in on another computer to help you process through the jobs? But you'd be dealing with maybe 40 one-on-one calls, like, on your screen at any one time, and you might only
40.
There's so much that happens behind the screen, that behind the scenes, that people don't even realize, dude. But 40 is like a normal amount, especially for West Auckland or Central Auckland or even counties.
What the heck?
Yeah, and it's just like, even after dealing with all those jobs, you'd only have maybe four or five cop cars that you can choose from for that area. And so a lot of the time it's like, man, I just got to maintain the chaos. Just keep on top of the updates that are coming in. Let the sergeants know as to what's happening and so that they're aware. And a lot of the time it's just diverting cop cars to other emergencies that's more important to the other one and trying to figure out like what to do. It's
that
nuts.
That sounds crazy.
And as a dispatcher, you are solely responsible for that area. So each 111 call is just one dispatcher responsible for all of these emergencies, you know? And if a pursuit comes in, like a fleeing driver incident, back then we would chase cars all the time. But if a pursuit came in, that would take up a lot of radio time. So if a cop car says, oh yeah, we've got a failing to stop on this road, and then all of a sudden we've got a pursuit, like it's on. They are chasing that car for whatever reason, and they are providing radio updates about it's turning left, left, left on this road. It's turning right, right, right on this road. And all the other cops in the area are trying to get ahead of it to set up spikes. And it's all intense and it's all go. And everyone's on board. But you don't realize there's other emergencies that might still be coming in on the screen. People are still calling 111. And you still got to figure out how to dispatch that to another cop car that's wanting to be a part of this pursuit. And you're like, oh, it's so stressful.
Is that one of the reasons they stopped? Have they stopped chasing people then? You said they used to chase them a lot more, but not anymore.
The biggest reason was the fatal accidents that was happening.
Yeah.
And the amount of pursuits that was happening was the majority of them. It seems like the crashes, based on the reports that came out, they said that police chasing the fleeing vehicle was a factor, I guess. It was like a considering factor in their speed or their aggressive driving. And so to mitigate that, they would just tell cops to, okay, we're just going to back right off to try and reduce their speed. So if we stop chasing them, maybe they'll stop driving so crazy and stop killing themselves, you know?
Wow. But doesn't that just mean that, you know, the car thief or whoever it is could just speed off from the cops and there's nothing you guys can do?
Welcome to my world, mate.
Oh, my goodness. Because they know that you can't chase them, so they could just boost off.
Yeah, welcome to policing. Yeah, that's like...
Oh, my gosh.
It doesn't happen all the time. Like, we still chase some cars, and for good reason. We just have to justify it. But, a lot of the time, if it's not a high-risk situation, there's no point even pursuing. We'll just abandon it straight away.
Yeah. And so you mentioned you were 6 months on the front line. Like, what does that mean, on the front line, for a police officer?
A public safety team is essentially where you get stationed on a section of however many cops, and you are paired up with a partner for a shift, and you get dispatched from comms. You get dispatched to 111 calls throughout your shift, and you and your partner deal with whatever jobs that come in. And that's essentially your role. You just get dispatched to emergencies, and anything and everything that could come in. You're mostly priority one jobs, priority one and priority two jobs. That's the public safety team. That's you guys just dealing with any full-on emergency that comes in.
And is that classified by like someone's life or is in danger or someone could be getting injured or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the first thing that is always, like, within seconds of a 111 call, they're always thinking of, you know, risk to safety. That's how to prioritize the job in the first few seconds of the job, you know. And the call taker is usually gauging that initially and then sending it to the dispatcher, and the dispatcher is assessing that as well. And everyone on the front line, we're all reassessing constantly the level of risk every time we're going to an emergency. Sometimes a job would come in and we get dispatched to a historic family harm call that might have happened a few hours ago. But then, so we're kind of cruising on our way there, Then all of a sudden we get an update saying the informant's back on the phone. He's returned. He's got a knife. He's going crazy. Like, you guys need to get here. And all of a sudden, you know, the priority changes. And so we have to constantly assess that risk.
Well, I have to say I owe you guys an apology, because I was in Palmerston North and a guy was trying to break into our house. And one of the girls in our flat was downstairs, and she like called up to me and was like, someone's trying to break in. And Sheesh. At this point we'd been robbed about 4 or 5 times, and I was like, what? Just really angry. Dude. And I was thinking, like, I'm going to get this guy, because I'm sick of this crap. I don't want him to come back.
Yeah.
And I bolted down the stairs. I saw him in the backyard. He jumped the fence. He had a bike with him, and he threw the bike over the fence. And I assumed he'd just stolen the bike from one of our neighbors or something.
Yeah, right.
So I leapt over the fence, like, caught his shirt, but he like ripped out of my grip. He was a really big guy.
Dude, you were chasing the guy. Started running off.
Yeah. I was chasing him, so I leapt the fence, chased him down the driveway. He had a getaway car. The car boosted off without him when they saw I was chasing him, left him behind, which was fantastic. His mates just ditched
classic.
Him. And then I ran down the street after him, and he was, I was going to catch him because he was trying to push his bike.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, do I tackle him? What do I do? And, and then he like half turned his head as he was running and said, I've got an effing knife and I'll cut you if you touch me. And then I was like, okay, I'm not going to tackle this guy. I was like, nah, it's not worth it. So I pulled my phone out and called the cops, and I was chasing him like for a good maybe 3 blocks through Palmerston North, saying, like, this guy was trying to break into a house. He says he's got a knife. And and I just kept thinking at every corner there's going to be a cop car that's going to, like, whiz up and tackle him. You know? And there was no cop car. There was no cop car. And then finally we ended up, like, jumping all these fences, and I lost him these properties.
Yeah.
And about 5 minutes later, the cops, like, got to my location. I was like, I don't know where he is.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, man, what were these cops doing? They're just sitting around eating donuts, like, bloody lazy. But you just told me they've got 40 calls at once, and there's probably someone getting beaten up in their house
or someone.
So I have to say, I apologize.
Oh, no, man, that sounds like an intense situation. I did not understand
you were so busy. My life wasn't in danger. You know, I was just chasing him. So
yeah, flip.
I kind of get it when they're prioritizing, like, risk. And but yeah, in my head, I was like, man, there must be some good donuts. So
yeah, yeah, man.
Oh, but exactly. I was wrong.
Oh, man, it's so
the front line.
Yeah, man. Sorry. Well, it's so easy to get into that red mist. You know, like that. They find that even for police, that red mist can be quite dangerous, especially in our line of work, because when someone says like that, you're just lucky that he warned you. He might not have even had a knife on him, you know, but that threat, you're fortunate he actually told you to back off or he's going to stab you, kind of thing, because it was only then that you realized, oh, I probably shouldn't to get hands on with this guy.
Yeah.
You know,
I had the red mist.
Yeah.
I was going to grab him.
Yeah. Because you don't know what he's got, what he's going to do. And at the end of the day, if he's stealing stuff, man, stuff is nowhere near as important as your life, you know?
For sure.
And we find in our line of work, if someone's, you know, at a front door and we're there to, you know, arrest him or something, and he might come to the door compliant, you know, all good to chat with us, and then the guy might say, okay, yeah, you're under arrest for whatever. And he says, nah, stuff you, and then runs out the back door. A lot of cops will just don't even think. They'll just chase him through the front door. But so many people, you don't even realize what's inside the house. If you've never been in the house, there's probably a firearm hidden behind the wall. You know, there's a bunch of knives around the place. You have no idea what you're walking into.
Well.
And so before you even do anything like that, you have to have a plan, you know.
Wow.
All this, red mist, it's so real. It's a very real thing. And, it's something you have to always consider.
So being able to step back out of the mist, as you call it, and assess the situation instead of just going from that.
Oh, absolutely.
I've heard it called the lizard brain. The lizard brain, when you're in like fight or flight, you're just a lizard just going crazy.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Stepping out of lizard brain back into human brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So what is the most dangerous calls that you go to? What would you consider the most dangerous one?
It's got to be firearms, surely. I mean, the amount of firearms jobs that I've been to is a bit insane, really. Thankfully, I've never had to be in a shootout, and I've never had to pull the trigger, which I'm very thankful for. But I have had to present my firearm at people. You know, I've had to challenge people at gunpoint and arrest them and sometimes talk them down from holding a weapon up at me, you know.
Wow.
Thankfully, I haven't had to, you know, go so far. But it's, I've been in a lot of firearms jobs, one in particular where it was pretty crazy, and one of my colleagues at the time was almost stupid with how he was dealing with it. It was almost comedic. Like it was bad. But we had this reports of firearms getting shot, you know, shots fired at an address, and a car fled the scene. And so we're on their way to the area. A lot of us are dispatched to the emergency at this stage. And so there was this victim that presented themselves at a gas station with gunshot wounds to the front of their legs.
Whoa.
And so their shins are blown out, bleeding, and then we hear that the Eagle helicopter catches sight of the fleeing vehicle down another road nearby. So there's that to consider. And now more shots were fired at the address. So now we got three different scenes to deal with. So one cop car goes to the victim at the gas station. Some other cop cars go to the address to deal with that. And then me and another couple of cop cars are prioritized on doing the armed vehicle stop for this car. And we're following the car. There was an unmarked police car in front of us to monitor it. But the problem was that it pulled into a supermarket car park where it's a broad daylight. There's a bunch of other people around. So we're thinking, oh no, what the heck's going to happen? And it pulls into the car park and stops. And we realize, okay, we just need to deal with it. So we do our armed vehicle stop. We get out. And man, one of my colleagues, oh, flip, he was so dumb. He gets out of the passenger car of his patrol car, and he doesn't even get behind cover. He just stands out wide in the open.
Oh, no.
Holds his rifle up in the aim point and screams at them at the top of his lungs to get out of the car. And he's all the while, he's just like standing wide out in the open.
Oh, no.
Thankfully, the offenders in this car were compliant. And they came out, and that was all good. But my colleague was like yelling at them. He was so red misting so hard that he was squeezing his rifle so hard that he hit the mag release, and his magazine dropped onto the ground. And the dude didn't even realize, bro. He didn't even realize that it dropped it.
Whoa.
And he's still like screaming at them, and I'm like, I'm yelling at him. I'm calling his name. I'm like yelling at him multiple times, like, bro, get behind cover, oi! Like, and he's not listening to me at all.
Oh my god!
Finally, after like my 10th call, he hears me and gets behind the car. Still doesn't even realize his magazine's dropped on the ground. And then the people come out of the car, and they're coming up compliant, and we're bringing them out, and we arrest them. And as they're walking past, one of the offenders kneels down and picks up the mag and says, oh, is this one of your guys? I'm like, bro, you're so dumb. Man, how the hell did you? I just thank God that this idiot didn't have the safety off, man, because he would have flipping shot someone by accident, you know, like, holy cow, he had no idea what he was doing.
I have to say that, like, with that whole red mist, lizard brain kind of thing, which this fella clearly was stuck in, which it happens to all of us. Like people would have said that about me if I tackled that robber and got stabbed. I'd have been like, what was he thinking? But I have to say that I trained jiu-jitsu for a few years, and getting myself into these terrible, I'm sounding like Joe Rogan or Jocko Willick or something, but it's true, like getting myself into these situations where I'm being choked all the time, and you want to go into that lizard brain, that fight or flight, but you just over like you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of training and getting constantly put in these positions where you're like really uncomfortable, you kind of, I found that it was translatable to other situations in like life when I wasn't rolling with someone, where I probably before would have gone into that fight or flight mode.
Yeah.
But I feel like because I was able, I sort of desensitized, that it helped. Do you think that officers doing some kind of combat sport or martial art or something could be quite beneficial for that, or something else, some other practice?
That stuff is always going to be beneficial, man. Like, it's, I don't know how it couldn't be helpful, you know? The stuff we deal with every day, it's literally hands-on. Everything we do is, you know, in person and hands-on with people all the time. It's that kind of training is always going to be helpful. I'd love to be able to get more into that kind of training myself, but I don't, you know.
Yeah.
for other reasons, but you know, I did it a while ago and it was cool, and when I had more time, and it was great. But
well, you guys know, are on a hard schedule, right?
Yeah, well, the shift work kind of limits a lot of the regular appointments that you can keep during a week, you know. And so if someone's got a training twice a week at a particular time of day, you know, you can show up to it if you're on a Monday to Friday roll, which is great. And I was doing that on a Monday to Friday roll for a while, where I was on the youth engagement team for a year, and that was just a slower pace Monday to Friday. But you know, working on the front line, it's that is a bit more challenging to find the time to do that kind of stuff.
Oh wow! And how was it with youth?
Oh, with the youth engagement team, it was, it was initially, I didn't really think much of it because I always wanted to be back on the front line. That was where my passion is.
Mm.
But I definitely got a lot out of it, I have to say. I worked with a lot of first-time offenders being in the youth engagement team, because the team was all that I was in was kind of split. So the youth aid team are more of the youth prosecutions team that would deal with the prolific offenders and kids that have to be opposing bail and basically you young people that actually need to be charged and held accountable for their actions. And they'd be doing that through family group conferences and youth court and other things like that. Whereas my team on the youth engagement team, it was more of exactly the job title is just engaging with them, especially with first-time offenders, doing home visits with the whānau, doing sit-downs with them and trying to figure out what has caused this kid to act out the way he has, even if it is acting out or if it's something that he was just caught up in with hanging out with his mates or whatever it is. A lot of it stems from family harm, to be honest. Right. I was dealing with a lot of those young kids that were just, and unfortunately, a lot of those kids that I was dealing with, I met them at the start before they pretty much carried on their criminal careers.
Mm.
And so I unfortunately got to see how they started and saw how much they declined as they progressed, because I saw the first arrest or the first incident, and then finding in their profile later on, it's like, man, what are we doing? Like these kids aren't changing. They're just like making it worse and worse. But the system that we had with the youth engagement team, it's a good design for first time offenders, because if we can catch them and they actually want to change, or if we can catch them early and we can divert their attention into putting them into a course or whatever it is to find that energy that they've got pent up to just do something else, it can be quite positive and constructive for their upbringing. But with the guys who just want to do it for the fun of it or join youth gangs, it kind of falls flat quite a lot, which is where the youth aid team have to pick it up and deal with them more often.
It's obviously been a massive topic in New Zealand at the moment, like big election topic as well, with a lot of youth offending and problems with youth crime, and you mentioned that a lot of the issues start within the family, with harm and abuse and things like that. Is that almost always the case when a kid's going off the rails? Yeah.
I have never had a young person that came a profile or a case that's come onto my desk. I've never had a case that hasn't stemmed from some form of family harm history or split home.
Right.
You know, whether the parents aren't living together or there's alcohol and drug abuse in the home.
Right.
Or something like that. I've never had anything without that. It's crazy, but it's pretty much always gone hand in hand from my experience.
Right. So it sounds like things like, you know, youth jails and boot camps and all that stuff is sort of like a last resort, and like the stem of the problem starts with intrinsic family dynamics and problems, family violence, child abuse, absolutely, broken homes. So I wonder if there's anything as a country we can do for that, you know, like.
Yeah, well, that's why the whole youth engagement process, it always started with a home visit to sit down with the whānau
and
try our best to do some kind of wraparound service.
Yeah.
Because as a youth engagement officer, you wouldn't just be a cop going in to have a chat with these families. You'd be sitting down sometimes with the Oranga Tamariki staff or some youth service in the community that would come in and sit down with them. Sometimes a lot of social workers, you'd make a lot of connections as a cop within the community to help this family. So you'd talk to one service that would help provide them food and blankets for the house because they're falling flat on that.
Mm.
You'd talk to one service that's a youth social worker that would catch up with this young person regularly, you know, and take them out to courses and stuff. And you'd talk to another community service that would do some financial counselling for the parents, you know, whatever it might need to be. And so the whole idea of the youth engagement process was to try and put the onus back onto the community to help each other, you know, because it's not going to work if, you know, police are solely responsible for fixing everyone's problems, because it's never going to solve the problem.
Totally. And I guess that's why things like the local church are so important for that like supporting one another, supporting whānau to whānau, and that idea of kotahitanga, that one people being one community and helping one another. And I believe that's what we need a lot more of in this country. And it's sort of like a symptom, isn't it, of a bigger problem.
It always has been. Yeah. Like this one kid that I was dealing with, he didn't have any criminal history when I first dealt with him, but I'd caught him trying to steal a car in a car park next to a train tracks, and we get to the car and he's jumped into the train. So I jump onto the train and I arrested maybe four of these kids, and you could tell that were like first time offenders because they were so scared. They just dropped everything, hands in the air, and you know, surrendered, which is great, and it made our jobs a whole lot easier. But taking him home, man, this auntie that he was staying with is a gang enforcer, you know, like this person who would just go out and just, it is known for tax collecting, essentially, you know. So there's that in the home that this kid is dealing with. And as soon as we drive him home to hand him back to his mum, the mum comes out and just verbally abuses the kid, yelling at him in the driveway right in front of me. And I'd spent the last half hour dealing with this kid, taking him on the way home to, you know, trying to talk to him positively and encourage him that, you know, this isn't the only thing in life, you know, you can do other things in life to better yourself. And then we get home and he's just getting abused by his mum right in front of me.
Yeah.
And this kid breaks down, just sobbing, crying in the driveway. And then he just says, nah, stuff this, I don't want to be here, runs up the top of the driveway, and I follow him, and he's just crying on the footpath on the roadside. And at this stage, it was a tense situation, because not only was I there to just drop the kid off to his parents, but there was a known criminal inside that house who was wanted for arrest.
Oh, wow.
And it was just like we had Eagle helicopter and detectives surrounding the house for that purpose as well. So it was like me dropping this kid off was a foot in the door to try and, you know, help not only help this family, but actually locate this dude that we wanted to arrest.
Wow.
It was just, it, and as this kid's crying on the footpath, he hugs me and wraps his arms around me and just cries on my shoulder. And we're just standing in the middle of the footpath on the roadside. And the Eagle helicopter's overhead watching this, and some other detective down the road is watching this. And then I'm just like hugging this kid.
Wow.
I calm him down and we walk back down to his mum. And what's crazy was the gang enforcer, the auntie that was there, she saw me hug her nephew and she extended her hand and shook my hand.
Wow.
Which was like unheard of.
Yeah.
Especially for someone of that nature.
Yeah.
And then after that, they invite us inside to do some voluntary, you know, fingerprints and stuff for the kid, which we don't do anymore, but it was just something that we used to do to help deter young people from future offending. But
yeah,
I mean, that there's a whole lot of reasons why we don't do that anymore, but it was a foot in the door. We were welcomed inside. It was calm. We had a nice, peaceful conversation with the family, albeit we didn't locate the person that everyone else was after at the time.
Mm.
He was probably hiding in the roof somewhere, but I mean, at the end of the day, we didn't want to rock the boat that didn't need to be rocked at that stage. We were just, you know, there for the kid in my mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the reality of these kids' lives on the daily, every day.
That's crazy. And it's a powerful example of like how some love and compassion can open doors and maybe create opportunities to bring about real change. And at least start the process of change and intervention. I mean, of course, there's times where you have to make arrests and people have to go to jail and people have to be out of the public sphere. But ideally, you don't want it to get to that point, do you? And it seems like these moments that you're just describing are pretty crucial in that process.
Yeah. For us as cops, this is another day at work, but these are, you know, people's lives that we're dealing with. Their whole future could be based on this one day at work that we're going to, you know?
Yeah. And before we wrap up, Eamon, I was going to ask you, like, if there is someone listening thinking of being a cop, maybe they are to a banker or an accountant or, you know, coming out of school or whatever. What would you say to them if they're thinking about it, but they're not sure?
Oh, man, it's the best job I've ever had. Wow. Oh, flip. It's so much fun. I'd say if you are interested, firstly, if you've got a partner or anything like that, make sure that they are on board with it first.
Yep.
Before you apply. But if you're just afraid or not sure of what you're capable of, I'd say just give it a go. Submit your application and actually give the tests a go.
Yeah,
because you may surprise yourself. If people realise there's actually so many different parts of policing that they can get involved in, it's not just frontline. You know, if people are not inclined to work on the frontline, there's so many other roles. You can work in forensics. You can work in youth, like I mentioned. You could work in CIB, the detective squad, where you just do a whole lot of Monday to Friday roles there, or you could even work in a tactical group like the Armed Offenders Squad or the Strategic Tactics Group, or even if you want to work in the helicopter, they've got a section there. There's fun. So many different parts. So
awesome. Hey, man, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. We've learned a lot about what it means to be a police officer in New Zealand, and there's some really great insights you provided.
Thanks so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care, man.
Cheers, bro.